This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Music, the show that looks at the money behind the music industry with me, Steve Lamack, and Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge. Stuart, a massive story about the global music industry this week, which we'll get to very shortly. Before that, what's the shortest gig you've ever been to? The one that lasted the least amount of time?
Oh, goodness. I think it's got to be probably at least half an hour, I would say.
Right,
But I'm trying to think who it was. Oh, I did go and see. Actually, this feels nice. I went to see a band called The Rub once, which was Rennie from the Stone Roses' band.
Okay.
And the gig carried on for the regular time, but most of the audience were in the bar after about 12 minutes.
Right.
So that was okay. That's the record where the audience decided when the gig was over rather than the band. But how about you?
Well, I mean, I've seen some very short gigs. There was a band called Birdland who barely played for 25 minutes some nights. And of course, there's, you know, the old days of the Mary Chain. I mean, I mentioned this because I was chatting to a friend, one of my Scottish friends the other day, and he was saying that there are a few disgruntled fans in Glasgow after John Squire and Liam Gallagher played a gig at the Barrowlands in Glasgow recently. And not just because they come on and say, yeah, we're not doing any Oasis songs, we're not doing any Stone Roses numbers. No, it was because, they played the new songs from their recent number one album, did a cover of Jumping Jack Flash, and that was it. That was the end. On and off in 49 minutes. The price for a ticket to that gig, according to my contact, £75. £75 for 49 minutes, which I think is interesting because in standard value for money terms, is that good value? I don't know. It's nearly £2 a minute. And then obviously that begs the question, how do you quantify what live music is worth? Because, I mean, if someone there might have had the best 49 minutes of their life, you know, if that gig was inspirational, if it was an incendiary 49 minutes that you'll never forget, then, you know, that's priceless. £75 is a snip. But if you're a casual consumer and, you know, there is part of the audience who will have gone to this gig expecting, rightly or wrongly, you know, a night, an evening's worth of entertainment, given the ticket price, then they're going home gnashing their teeth. And I wonder whether this is, I don't know what you think about this, but I wonder if this is, you know, all changing in the current musical landscape because ticket prices are going up and up and are our expectations going up with them? Do you see what I mean?
Mm. I read a thing a while ago about how students were protesting more often about the quality of teaching in universities. And the thing that triggered that was when the student fees went up and up and up. And suddenly it was like, we're paying a lot of money for this. We need to have lots of hours. But yeah. I mean, it's weird, isn't it? Because like length is arguably not the best way to measure a gig. I mean, if you did that, like someone like The Cure would be amazing because they play 3-hour sets, don't they? Springsteen plays 3-hour sets.
Yeah.
They're good and people love them. But you don't want a band to come on and play for 2 hours just to make you feel you've got the price of a ticket. If that means, I remember seeing the Black Crowes play the Brixton Academy. And there's two songs they have. And on record, there's a little piano coda between them that lasts for about 20 seconds. But live, that's when they do the jam.
Right.
And so this time I saw them, I went from the middle of the crowd at Brixton Academy to the toilet, had a wee, came out, went to the bar, queued at the bar, got drinks, got back to my place, and they were still in this kind of 20 second coda, soloing away, and that I thought that was wonderful. But you wouldn't want your, you want bands to be doing that sort of thing just to make sure you were there past 11 o'clock, I think. So it's a bit of a risk.
I love the fact you've got the Black Crowes into another episode of the programme.
All the time.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. And there's, I mentioned that the Mary Chain, we used to go and see the Jesus and Mary Chain play for barely 20 minutes, but it was, you know, inspirational stuff. 15 minutes and a riot. I mean, you know, there's a night out for you.
I'm surprised that the Glasgow crowd didn't, I mean, like, Glasgow crowds are famously, they'll let you know if you're not what they wanted. I'm surprised maybe they didn't do their own riot at the end of the 49 minutes of John Squire and Liam Gallagher. Maybe they didn't.
Let us know your own feelings about this. What's the shortest gig you've ever been to, dear listener? Or the gig that you consider to be the worst value for money? priceofmusicpodcast@gmail.com. Right, this week's big story. To start us off, the IFPI has put out its annual global music report, and it shows global recorded music revenues increased by more than 10% last year. How big a deal is this? Talk us through this one.
Yeah, and I'm going to try not to just babble percentages because there are a lot of numbers in this. But yeah, so the IFPI, like you said, it's a global labels body. So the main thing to understand is this is recorded music only. It's not live. It's not songwriters publishing. It's not merchandise. It's just the music itself, the recordings. And yeah, so revenues are up 10.2% to $28.6 billion, which is the ninth kind of year in a row of growth, which... And the reason people mention that so often is that, and I was looking it up actually, between 2001 and 2014, these revenues fell every year. Like, this is kind of from the days of piracy becoming a thing. So there were 14 years of basically decline. And since then, it's been going back up again. So everyone's quite excited about that. So again, it's not really a big new trend. It's a continuation of a trend. And yeah, it's unsurprisingly, it's about streaming. So streaming was $19.3 billion. So streaming is about 2/3 of all the money, and streaming subscriptions, so actually paying for streaming, is just under half of all the money. So $14 billion. And they had some numbers on that. They're like, this was quite interesting, that there are 503 million streaming subscriptions worldwide, but there are 667 million people using them. And that is that, you know, is family plans where one person pays and everyone else in the house freeloads. So there's kind of a sense there of like, you know, there's 164 million people who are kind of on family plans that someone else is paying for. So that's kind of, it was like this report. I mean, this report is amazing. It's kind of, it's for IFPI members, and it's like got all the stats, every single country's stats, all the stuff. If you're not an IFPI member, you have to buy it. And it costs £16,500 to buy this full report.
It costs what?
And it's basically a PDF, a really good PDF full of stuff.
I know, but that's more than a lot of musicians earn in a year. Though.
Money per page metric.
Yeah,
it's
Wow.
But yeah, so I mean, the other stuff, I was quite interested in the physical stuff. We talked about vinyl the other week, didn't we? And vinyl sales were up 15.4% to $1.7 billion. And that's the 17th year in a row of growth for vinyl. So that's, again, that trend, like, you know, it's not new. It's last 17 years, vinyl's been climbing up and up and up every year. And someone who's seen the full report told me that there's a chart in there of the global vinyl album sales for last year, the top 20.
Yeah.
And Taylor Swift was seven of them.
Oh.
So it's kind of a like everything else in the industry, it's a Taylor Swift-assisted growth at the moment.
Yeah.
But even CDs are growing. Like, CD sales are up 13.6% to $3 billion, which apparently this is really driven by Asia, where fans are kind of buying multiple copies of a CD album has become a thing there. And again, there's a top 20 global album sales chart, not including streams, just sales. And I think 19 of the top 20 were K-pop albums.
Really?
Because that's what's driving in South Korea. People go and buy loads of CDs. So yeah, even the things like vinyls, I was wondering, but even CDs are kind of bouncing back at the moment. Everything's going up.
That's really interesting, isn't it? That the return of the CD in certain territories, which just shows that all around the world, the music scene is slightly different and its consumption is slightly different, all slightly off kilter with each other. So they'll be going through, well, where will they go next? Will K-pop finally have its own vinyl revival, even though it was never available on vinyl in the first place. Maybe that's the thing. Then they'll press up all the CDs, the K-pop, the big K-pop albums will all be on double vinyl. There you go.
Well, that's the thing. And these bands, like the K-pop groups, their popularity around the world is being driven by streaming. So the reason BTS and Blackpink are so big over here is streaming. But back at home, yeah, it's you can sell a load of physical albums. So that's, yeah, it's fascinating.
Next, now, this actually ties in quite nicely. Following on from that, this is also it's sort of streaming related. After criticising the way streaming revenue is distributed, James Blake, the artist James Blake, has announced his participation in the launch of Vault, a direct artist-to-fan streaming platform focused on unreleased music. Tell us about this idea, because I've got a couple of questions, but if you could outline it for us first.
Yeah, sure. So this started earlier this month, actually in March, when James Blake went on this kind of Tom Gray-style tweet storm criticising the music industry. So right. He basically said streaming services don't pay properly, labels want more of a bigger cut than ever,
yeah.
TikTok doesn't pay properly, and touring is getting expensive for most artists. So he was voicing complaints that I think we hear a lot from artists. But he said, like, he hinted, oh, I'm working on something that could fix this. And then, yeah, last week he unveiled it. So it's not his startup. It's a startup called Vault, which I think existed already. But then they saw this and they got in touch with them and they're working together now. And yeah, basically, as an artist, you can upload unreleased tracks and then fans can pay to unlock them. So in James Blake's case, it's $5 a month and you will unlock, or is it $5? Might be just $5 one-off payment, but $5, you unlock his unreleased tracks and he could add more over time. Right. And there's going to be a chat room as well where artists can kind of drop in and chat to fans. And then James said that the other key thing here is that artists will own all the data on those fans. If you're an artist and you're on Spotify, you don't get the details of the fans who've co-following you. You don't get their email address or anything. Whereas here, you'll have more power to kind of contact them and do stuff.
Unreleased songs, so old songs or work in progress songs? I mean, Vault suggests more that it's, you know, back catalog things which have been lying around in the cupboard, but it could be new. So it could be new songs I guess which haven't been out yet. Although then again, how does this work then if you are signed, if you've got a record label, are they going to let you just put out unreleased material through this for your own gain?
So as I understand it, most contracts say you release exclusively with us while you're under contract for us. And that's a theory. And actually someone asked him about this on Twitter or whatever it's called, X. James answered this. He said, yeah, it's going to be a negotiation with your label. And he actually releases through Public Records, I believe, at Universal. So he's obviously talked to his label and said, I want to do this.
Yeah.
And that's where your label might say, yeah, go ahead, we don't mind. They might say, well, can we have a slice of the money? Or they might say no. But it would be surprising to say no to an artist who they want to keep hold of, because, you know, obviously they'll feel frustrated then. And it could be anything, like you say. I mean, it's like my worry or my, one of my, like, I want to say there's lots of good things about this, but one of my concerns is unreleased music is sometimes unreleased for good reasons. Like it wasn't finished or it wasn't. So it really does depend on the artist of what they've got, how good it is, and how curious their fans are about it. And I'm trying to think, like, of all the artists you love, I do like hearing stuff that hasn't been released before, but it's curiosity rather than, yeah, I'm going to go and pay money for that necessarily. Like, I think you need to have a special relationship with your fans for them to want to pay.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I agree. But then what happens if Black Crowes had a Vault? Mm. As a fan, would you sign up to that for however much, five quid a month or something? You probably would you? I'm trying to read your face, and I can see you thinking it over. Is that value for my? Would I? Am I that much of a super fan?
I think the thing is, we're coming from a model where you remaster albums and you have an extra CD of all the unreleased stuff. So in a way, I've got like unreleased Black Crowes stuff coming out my ears already on streaming services, that was the model, you released it through those. So yeah, I mean, if they, but I don't know, again, it's like, there are other things I'd rather pay for. I'd rather pay to see them live. I'd rather pay. But the other thing here is, and actually I read some research this week about superfans saying actually they don't necessarily want unreleased stuff. What they want is access to the artists, a chance to kind of chat to them, chance to see what they think. So in a way, the vault might be as interesting for the stuff around it, the social bits,
for the chat room.
But it is just one of many. Like that's the other thing. I don't want to feel like I'm pouring cold water on this, because the good thing here, I think, is like I love seeing artists when they have a profile and they have reached a certain point. Criticizing streaming is all very well and good, and it's interesting to hear that. But I love it when they actually go the next step over and go, well, I'm going to try and do something about it. I'm going to try and find someone to work with. And that's James Blake not just carping from the sidelines. He's getting stuck in and saying, well, I'm going to try this thing. And he's being really transparent about it. He's answering questions on Twitter. That's good. But there are a bunch of other things like this. Like, I mean, you could do this sort of thing on Bandcamp already. You could upload your unreleased songs and sell them there. You could do a Patreon. There's a whole bunch of apps that are like, get your super fans to subscribe and give them stuff. So it's one of many. It's not like a massively special thing that hasn't been done before. But the special thing here is that James Blake is going, right, I'm going to stick my flag in this and kind of, you know, try it and talk about how it works. So it's good. It's interesting, I think.
We'll see how it pans out. To finish this week, the Elvis Act has been signed into law in Tennessee to protect artists' voice and likeness from the misuse of AI. And obviously, I was hoping, having finally seen the Elvis Presley movie on the flight to Austin the other week, I was thinking, oh, the Elvis Act. I thought this will be about the Presley. It really isn't, because Elvis, the Elvis in the Elvis Act, Elvis stands for?
Ensuring likeness, voice and image security.
There you go.
But this is the one of the things I love about America, is that often when they have a new bill, like a new bill in the Senate and the Congress, they'll have these tortuously crafted acronyms for it. Like the best one, there's a ticketing one. I don't know if you ever saw this. You know, do you remember when like there was a whole thing about Taylor Swift tickets and Bruce Springsteen tickets and touting and prices, and there was a lot of controversy about a couple of years ago?
Yeah.
They did a bill to deal with this, and it was called the Boss and Swift Act.
Right.
So, Springsteen. But that stood for better oversight of stub sales and strengthening well-informed and fair transactions for audiences of concert ticketing act. And they've made an acronym to fit the Boss and Swift. So the Elvis Act is that. Nothing to do with Elvis, sadly.
I've got one for you. I've got one for this podcast. So Domino's, that's us. Delivery of musical insight, news, opinion and editorial suggestions. Domino's. There we go.
I like it. Will the label sue us though?
Yeah. Oh, crikey. I love the way you're already one step ahead of me. Ensuring likeness, voice and image security act all about then? What is it aimed to achieve?
Well, it's about deepfakes, basically AI deepfakes. I mean, it's about a bunch of things, but it's essentially about this idea of protecting musicians, but also other entertainers, other prominent figures, from people using an AI to kind of create a deepfake of their voice or their image. So the whole kind of someone made a fake Drake song that sounds like it was him, but it wasn't him stuff that we've seen happen in the last kind of year or so. And it's the first, well, certainly in the US, it's the first state to make any kind of law that covers this sort of AI deepfakery. It's obviously only in one place, in Tennessee, which is like famous, like Nashville is the capital. It's a famous musical heart. And they wanted to be the first, I think, to make a law that protected the musicians and the community of Tennessee. But it's kind of part of this bigger argument, because the music industry really wants this kind of legislation to be everywhere, be across the US, be here in the UK, be in Europe as well, to say you can't just train your AI on a bunch of a musician's songs, their voice, and then help either put it yourself or help people put stuff out that is pretending to be them. But it's also a much bigger issue. Like deepfakes are about political misinformation. Like there was a thing recently where there seemed to be a call from President Biden telling people how to vote, but it wasn't him. It was someone had done a deepfake of him. It's about deepfake porn, even, not to get into those waters too deeply, but the idea of making deepfake porn of celebrities or just someone you know. So there's a whole bunch of ways this technology can be misused. And I think people who are making the laws are sort of scrambling to say, okay, we want to deal with this and say it's not good, but we want to make sure we do it right, because we don't quite understand it yet and how it could develop. So this is one of the first examples of someone saying, okay, we're going to have a law. I'm not sure what happens now. I'm trying to think of a famous Tennessee artist, Dolly Parton, I suppose, famous Tennessee artist, isn't she?
Mm.
Is she? I'll get in trouble. People say, no, she's not.
I made an affirmative sound and then thought, actually, do you know what? I don't know.
No, I think. But so say a massive famous artist from Nashville, if you create a deep fake of them, can you be sued in Tennessee now? And what happens if you say, well, I don't live there? I'm not quite sure how it's enforced, but people are very happy about it, that someone has taken this action, because it kind of lays down a marker of saying, if you're going to tackle deep fakes, this is kind of the law you could do.
Yeah, I was going to say, does this set a sort of precedent? Do laws in one state, will they be adopted elsewhere? Is this where we're going to go? It's just going to take other states a little while longer.
Maybe so, yeah. I think it gives them that kind of incentive to say, okay, this is how it could work. But in the States, there's a big push to get this on a federal level so it will cover the whole of the US. And there's a move, and there's even a bill, I think, that's kind of trying to do that. The good thing, the flip side of all this, is one of the things I'm writing about a lot at the moment, is there's a bunch of startups starting to do this legally. So legal deepfakes, which sounds like a contradiction because a lot of the story's been negative. But this idea of you as an artist saying, actually, I want to license my voice so that people can make music with my voice, and I want to get paid for it, and I want to have approval before they release it so I know it's not going to be something that's against what I believe. So Grimes was the first artist to do it in the States. She did a whole bunch of things with that. DJ Fresh, who we talked about, I think we mentioned him before, DJ Fresh of Hot Right Now fame. He's a producer. He's got a startup doing it. And again, it's like, so there's a kind of a alongside the efforts to crack down on the bad stuff, there's a little industry emerging of like, actually, you might want to do this as an artist. You might want to say, I'm going to train an AI on my voice and then let other people do stuff with it.
So what did Grimes exactly do then? Said you can take my voice and do what you will with it, but for a cash payment, or did she license it to a company?
She worked with a company called CreateSafe, and they basically created an AI model of her voice. So they call it an AI clone, so a clone of your voice. And then people could download that software, use it, and make a song using her voice, having her singing whatever way they wanted her to sing. But what they had to do, so that they had to then submit it for approval. And she actually did a funny tweet. It was like saying, I don't want any kind of baby murdering songs or Nazi anthems. Like she was like, these, you know, I have some limits. I mean, those are quite good limits to have. And then also, I think she wanted half of the recording royalties, or half of the royalties. So there's a thing here about, like, cracking down on people doing it without artist permission. But there's also a positive side, which is like artists who want to being able to take control and say, actually, I'm going to try this out and see what happens, you know, see what ensues.
It's a little bit like active sampling, isn't it? It's a bit like taking, in the old days, you would have sampled a piece of Grimes, maybe, but now you can take the voice and actually manipulate it into what you want it to do. But it does mean, so it means essentially you could have Grimes guesting on your single. I don't know, do you get a credit for that? Do you have to credit them?
Yeah.
Could we put out a song under the Price of Music featuring Grimes? And then
we could. I mean, she might not approve it because you're like, who are you guys? but no, it's funny. This is a really interesting issue, emotive issue. Like, I went to a conference run by the Ivors Academy last year, so the songwriting body here. And they had a guy from the States talking about deepfakes, and he was really interesting, but he was also quite cross about the idea. And he said someone took Johnny Cash's voice and cloned it and made him sing the Barbie theme song. And he was really cross about this. And this is a room full of songwriters and publishing people who you should think would be cross. And everyone was looking at each other, either going, that sounds brilliant, I want to hear it, or saying, I've heard it, it's brilliant. And the outrage was maybe lacking in that case, because people felt like, okay, it's obviously not Johnny Cash singing the Barbie theme song. It's a parody and it sounds funny. So there are different opinions about how sometimes it's harmful, sometimes it's not. But I think that the Tennessee thing is about, well, artists need to have control over this.
Yeah,
they need to be able to solve, and we need to take action.
Did you see the video for the Idols track Grace? Have you come across that? That's the Chris Martin deep fake, which, as I understand it, did start. They did their own deep fake. It's if you've not seen it, it's Coldplay's Yellow video, which is just Chris Martin walking down a beach singing the words to Yellow. And Idols took it and managed to somehow deep fake it so that Chris Martin was singing all the lyrics. Well, he's not singing them. Joe Talbot, the singer of Idols, is singing them. But it appears that Chris Martin on this video is singing the lines to the Idols song Grace. And I think they got that far with it that I think they probably suddenly got the fear that they put all this work into it. And if they put it out unofficially, then that would be taken down quite quickly. So Joe sent, I think, got in contact. I was going to say sent a letter. I suspect he didn't send a letter. Probably more likely sent an email. To Chris Martin or to Coldplay's people and said, look, we've got this thing. And Chris Martin went, yeah, I love it. Let us lot have a little play around with it. I mean, it meant they sort of missed the deadline for when the single was coming out, but they improved on it, and now it's turned from something which was originally a kind of pirate escapade into the official video with the endorsement of Chris Martin from Coldplay.
It's one of those complicated things, I think, because there's when you get into the real weeds of rights here. But if you like, you can parody a Coldplay video. I could do a video walking down the beach like Chris Martin singing whatever I like, and there'd be no kind of grounds to sue me on that thing. But if you're taking the actual recorded music video for, was it Yellow, wasn't it, the beach one?
Yeah,
it was
a different one.
And you're editing it and putting stuff in, there probably is dodgier ground there. Although some people argue this stuff is parody and fair. Like, there's all kinds of people arguing about what is protected and what isn't protected. And can you copyright someone's face versus someone's recorded music and that? So there's a lot of arguments around it. Oh, it's fascinating. But I like that, the idea that actually sometimes you ask permission and it's a creative thing and the person respects that. Like, that sounds like the ideal outcome in that scene, because Idols weren't doing it to belittle him or to enrich themselves. They were doing something that was funny and interesting and cool, and he obviously got it. The key here is, with a lot of AI stuff, it's actually humans deciding what to do with it. And when humans do something with respect and do things the right way, you can do good. Which kind of brings you back all the way around to the IFPI and their big music report, because as well as releasing all these stats, they had an event in London, they had music industry execs there, and they talked quite a bit about AI, and they were very clear on the idea that they think the music industry is embracing AI in the ways it can be a creative tool for musicians and artists can do stuff with it. And that's part of their argument for saying, we want laws to make sure we crack down on the bad stuff that artists don't have permission for, don't kind of want to do. So there's a lot of talk, I think, about the more, if the industry kind of puts its arms around the nice bits of AI that it likes, then it can also then push more strongly for kind of governments to make laws that kind of crack down on deep fakes, crack down on people trading music on the AI music without permission, all that stuff. So there's kind of the carrot and the stick here, and the carrot is going to be lots of cool stuff we can do with AI, and the stick is going to be, you know, hitting the bad people with it. That's my summary of the lawmaking process.
And that's about it for this episode. Dolly Parton is from Tennessee, I've just checked. Thank you very much for listening. If you've enjoyed the show, and we hope you have, please do subscribe in your podcast app and give us a review and a rating if you have a second. Maybe even tell a couple of your friends about it as well. We'd be forever in your debts. And if you have any questions you'd like answered on the program, email us at Stuart.
The Price of Music Podcast at gmail.com.
Till next time. Ta-ra.